It's a very strange concept for people because our entire monetary system is built on debt. So I always say, you know, debt makes the world go round. And, you know, without debt, if all the debts were paid off in the United States, for example, there'd be no money.
If you are close to retirement or recently retired, you can't afford to miss this commercial. What if I told you one of the biggest dangers to running out of money in retirement was a risk you've never heard of before? If you've never heard of sequence of return risk, please check out the trailer at sequenceofreturnrisk.com. And remember, an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. Benjamin Franklin.
Well, welcome everyone. This is the Crypto and Conspiracy Podcast, episode one. You guys can find this on the Libertarian Advisor Podcast. So we're available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, YouTube, a whole bunch of other things. So if you're watching this on YouTube or watching this on Facebook Live and you don't have all the time to dedicate to listening to a podcast right now, you can go back and, you know, download it on your on your iPhone or Samsung or whatever you have to watch this later on. But anyways, I'm Tim Pichot, and I'm here with my guest host, Matt McKeon. So Matt, you want to introduce yourself?
Tim, great to be on the podcast today. So I'm Matt McKeon. I live in Scottsdale, Arizona. My career has been spent as an entrepreneur, a lot of that in real estate finance, mortgage banking, almost 25 years, $3.5 billion in transactions between myself and companies I've CEO'd or sales teams I've run. And I have a entrepreneurial in the energy sector as well. Very interesting technology. We have patents in almost four continents. So happy to be here, and it's fun to speak with like-minded individuals and friends about, you know, the crazy happenings going on and the change that's going on in the world now. So thanks for having me on today. It's going to be a fun conversation.
Oh, no problem. And just so everybody knows, how I got a hold of Matt is we have a mutual friend named Teresa Farron. So if anyone needs health or life insurance, you guys make sure to check out Teresa. And Teresa told me, like, hey, you know, I'm friends with Matt McKeon. You guys are really always posting similar stuff on Facebook. I think you guys should get together. So I've actually only in person met Matt one time. So it's not like we were, you know, longtime friends going back, but, you know, we really hit it off. We actually both found out that we're also both Ironman triathletes, which is also, you know, a pretty rare thing here. And we work pretty close together. So, you know, today we're coming live from North Scottsdale. And what we really were interested in talking about is everything that's going on in the crypto space. So that would be, you know, the cryptocurrency space for some of you, the Bitcoin space, blockchain. You know, maybe these are words that, you know, don't necessarily mean a lot to you guys. What we want to do is really today is really break down what's going on in the fork. A lot of you might not even know what a fork is. And so we want to talk about, you know, what the fork is, you know, why did Bitcoin fork? Then get into some of the, you know, some of those issues of why Bitcoin had to fork. We also want to discuss, is Bitcoin a bubble or not? You know, I see a lot of people saying that this is basically the tulip mania 2.0. And for those of you who don't know what the tulip mania was, is I believe it was in the Netherlands, maybe like the 1600s, 1700s.
Yeah, 16th, 17th century, I think, yep.
Yeah, 17th century, you know, Holland. People were selling tulips, and the price started going astronomically high. I mean, at one point, people were probably paying like thousands of dollars for just regular tulips. And people were, you know, just betting and speculating on the price of tulips. And as long as they found somebody else to buy that tulip for more money, then people were willing to buy it because, you know, they could sell it to another fool later on down the road. But eventually, like all bubbles, it did collapse. I actually read about that first in a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes that I read actually in 2007, which then helped give me the foresight when I was part of my school's student managed investment team to actually specifically, I was in charge of financial stocks and made the recommendation not to buy any. So this is sort of a strange that you have myself as a financial advisor, and then you have Matt, where he also has a role doing mortgages. But yeah, we're kind of like the renegades in our industries that we both know how the system is rigged. And basically, we're at the standstill of, you know, the reason I wanted to get involved with cryptocurrencies is I really understood what was going on in the central banking system. And it's a system that really benefits myself. It's a system that benefits Matt because, you know, as financial assets go up, or really as central banks print more money, it creates stock prices to go up. It makes, you know, all financial assets go up. You know, people's home value goes up, and then they need more money to borrow to then take out a mortgage. So, you know, it really benefits you, it benefits me, because as my clients' account values go up, then I make more money as people take out larger and larger loans, because now the prices of the house cost more, then, you know, it benefits you. So we're actually literally speaking against our own self-interest here in trying to expose the central bank system. And really, you know, what, you know, at the crux of all this is the very first dollar that was ever created in 1913, that was based on debt. So essentially, if you created $1, at the end of year one, you would owe, let's say, $1.04. Well, Matt, how do you pay back $1.04 with $1?
You need more money.
And so what do you have to do? You have to borrow that dollar into existence. And so
it's a very strange concept for people, because our entire monetary system is built on debt. So I always say, you know, debt makes the world go round. And, you know, without debt, if all the debts were paid off in the United States, for example, there'd be no money.
Yeah, because you...
The money would all be zeroed out.
And so people want to talk about, you know, paying off the debt. Well, you can mathematically never pay off the debt. As a matter of fact, the debt has to keep growing just to be able to, you know, keep this whole GDP and Ponzi scheme going. And at some point, it's going to collapse. And there's a lot of different ways that it can collapse. So I don't know. We didn't really, like, talk about this in the little pre-interview we did. But I think, you know, I kind of like where this is going. Is that, you know, I see it really happening in one of two ways. One way could be, you know, the central banks have to print so much money that all of a sudden, you know, the value of everything goes, you know, through the moon, and maybe the stock market, you know, maybe the Dow Jones is at a million. And I think by the time I retire, I think there is a good case that it could be a million, but it's not going to be a million because, you know, all of these companies are earning a whole bunch of money. It's going to be because, you know, we've printed so much money that we've made the value of the dollar go down. So that's one way this could happen. The other way it could happen is you could have a deflationary crash where essentially what it means is the value of financial assets would go down. And I mean, correct me if you don't agree with this or not, but I think then the response to that would be we would then print so much money that eventually you'd have that same hyperbolic having the stock market go through the roof again anyways. It's just, I don't know what the timing of that is going to look like. I mean, I thought it would have happened maybe, you know, at least the deflationary part, you know, I thought maybe it would have happened like a year or two ago. So I'm sort of, you know, I didn't time it right from that standpoint, but, you know, I'd rather be a little bit early than even a second too late.
I'm a big student of Martin Armstrong Economics, phenomenal resource for anybody. Number one documentary, I think in 2016 in Europe, called The Forecaster, was banned in the United States.
Yeah, it's banned here.
It's banned in the United States and banned in Switzerland. So they banned the document. How many movies are banned in the United States? I mean, you know, there's, you know, porn for crying out loud, and you can't watch a documentary about a guy that was treated very badly by the U.S. government. And that's another conversation about, do we really have freedom? But Martin Armstrong, genius. I think his economic model, he's made some of the biggest predictions in history that have been right. He picked the crash in 1987 to the very day, years in advance. So when the stock market crashed in October 1987, and then he came out during the middle of the crash and he said the Dow's going to go into an all-time high at the end of 1988, picked the height of the Nikkei to the day, years in advance, picked the Russian financial crisis in 1997, picked the height of the real estate index in February of 2007 to the day, over a decade in advance. And his economic model uses mathematics and some interesting calculations to pick the business cycle, which has been the same for decades and hundreds and thousands of years, and that never changes because the business cycle always returns because human nature is the same. So it's actually very predictable. So I believe in the deflation is what kills the United States. We're trying to keep the dollar low, but what's going to hurt us is the strong dollar. So there's all these people talking about the dollar collapse coming. Well, the strong dollar is what's going to kill us because our dollar's too strong. We're not able to trade with people because our dollar's too strong. And so there's interesting things coming with, I believe the euro will begin to crash in 2018. You're seeing tremendous central bank problems. European Central Bank owns like 40% of all the debt in Europe.
Is that the new issuances from the ECB, or is that just like already in total? Because I think the percentage of the new one might even be higher than.
Well, there's about $10 trillion in negative interest rate debt out there.
So can you just explain to people what a negative interest rate is? So it's, you know, I give you $1,000 and you're going to promise to give me $998 in
return.
Right.
I'm such a safe place to put your money that I'll make sure you get back a little less than the money that you give me.
If anybody wants to do that, by the way, anybody wants to give me $1,000 and I'll give you back $998 in 2 years, you know, open for business. So
there's so much volatility and anxiety about European markets that European central banks, banks started coming out with negative interest rate policy bonds. So that's how crazy it is. So that's why the U.S. 10-year treasury is about 2.4 right now. And that looks like, you know, crazy type returns compared to a negative interest rate return. So you're going to continue to see money flee Europe, flee into the United States, in my opinion, and Armstrong's models. I believe the Dow is going to continue to climb significantly over the next few years, probably hit to 35 to 40,000 within the next 3 years, I believe is where it'll go.
Or it could go back down to 10. There's such variability here where it doesn't really matter, like for myself or yourself, because you're younger also, but you know, if you're 65 or you're 55 years old and you're, you know, counting on a pension or counting on your Social Security or counting on your 401k, you better be hedged a lot of different ways right now about how this can happen, because I'm young enough that, you know, if this all crashes tomorrow or 10 years from now, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only 31, so matter of fact, I'd rather have it happen sooner than later.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at even like Germany, I mean, Germany had, I don't know the exact currency names, but I think it was the Renmark, Reichsmark, Deutschmark. And, you know, if you were a German citizen holding on to, you know, I want to be safe and have all my money in, you know, the Renmark, well, then eventually that ended up collapsing. And then you had your money into the Reichsmark, and then that ended up collapsing. And so, you know, but if you had your money, let's say, in Mercedes-Benz, which is the oldest car company in the world, you know, now instead of having 100 shares priced in Renmark, maybe now you have 105 shares priced in Reichsmark. So by being in stocks, I think you're at least somewhat insulated from that, because, you know, the S&P 500 is not going to go to zero someday. There's always going to be companies that are out. There's always going to be the largest 500 companies in the world. There's always going to be the largest 100 companies in the world.
Yeah.
And then getting back to what you were saying about interest rates, it's crazy because in Japan right now, you have actual fascism going on currently where the central banks in Japan right now are taking, you know, their keyboards, printing up money out of thin air, and then using that money to then buy up the Nikkei 100. And so it's something like, I think it's like 75% of all new issuances. And again, I'm not looking at notes for that number right now, but I'm pretty sure it's somewhere in that ballpark of 75% of all new issuances are being bought by the Bank of Japan. So if you have a central bank that is then buying up their own companies, that is the merger of the state and corporations, and that's fascism. So where's Antifa and the left talking about fascism in that regard? Where's Antifa and the left should be cheering on Donald Trump for getting rid of the TPP. Don't want to really get into that today because that's a whole other can of worms. But, you know, as this relates to central banking, as the entire system we're under right now is predicated on the ability to print more and more debt so that way we can expand this Ponzi scheme of which we can never actually repay the debt. You can never repay the debt from day one. You could tax everybody 100%, assume they'd actually still work, which they wouldn't, and take all the rich people's money and assets, and you can still never pay off the debt. So it's a fraudulent system that, you know, that honestly I'm benefiting from right now working in the stock market, but I know that at some point, it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when it's going to collapse. And people want to say, oh, well, the dollar can never collapse, or America always honors its debt. I mean, bullshit. In 1971, in August, when Nixon got off the gold standard, that was defaulting on the debt because we were going to originally promise to pay you
return unit of gold for every
yeah.
dollar. Right?
Yeah, it was a dollar.
Currency was backed by a tangible asset.
Yeah, the dollar used
right.
to say, and for those of you who are watching this right now, or for those of you who are listening, you know, holding up a piece of paper that's shaped in a rectangle, kind of like a dollar. It used to say, you know, this is a, you know, a United States dollar. It used to say redeemable by gold
right.
on the top. At one point, even redeemable for silver very briefly. And now it's a Federal Reserve note. And again, not going to get into the whole, you know, Federal Reserve and all that Ponzi scheme, but this is why, you know, what crypto does is it gives us a way out of this system. It gives us a way to have a, you know, have no third parties involved in me transmitting value to you without having to go through a middleman to be able to do that. And that's, you know, probably one of the biggest reasons why crypto is so promising, that, you know, we're not saying go put 100% of your money into this. You know, and again, you shouldn't just trust somebody like us up here saying that, you know, you should, you know, definitely go invest in crypto. You should understand what it is before you try to invest in it. And I see a lot of people who are getting into this space just because they saw other people make money into it. And now they're throwing money at all these, you know, BS, you know, initial coin offerings or all these new
yeah, without
scam
any,
coins.
That was the, I know a guy that just, yeah, did one of those and, I wish I'd have got to him before, because he's down quite a bit, and really no understanding of the space at all, understanding the underlying technology, development, or historical basis as to why he's even getting into it other than to try and make money. And there's a word for that. It's called greed. You know, we should always do things well thought out and prudently, making wise decisions. And what we're talking about, you know, the currency and the debt structure, it's just very arrogant, I believe, as Americans to think, oh, we're America and American pride. And
this is the third central bank we've had. There was one that ended
right.
in 1812. You may have remembered that the British openly owned it, and they came down here and burned down the effing White House,
yeah.
which that's not really.
I've been in the basement of the White House. I've actually seen the blackened walls, actually, from the original White House. Yeah, I've actually seen that by the bomb shelter.
Oh, I've not.
It's
yeah,
pretty
I haven't
cool.
seen that.
Yeah.
But again, then we had a second Central Bank of America that Andrew Jackson then got rid of. And that's where, you know, I think Trump should take down his poster of Andrew Jackson, because Trump appointed a globalist in Jerome Powell to go run the Fed. Whereas, you know, his idol, Andrew Jackson, you know, said you guys are a den of vipers and my eternal God
bank.
I shall rout you out.
Right.
I mean, that's completely different. But, you know, Trump is in a very tough spot right now, where if you were to admit what we're talking about, then it would crater everything and he'd get the blame and couldn't get anything done. And so I think what he wants to do is, you know, great, we can buy, you know, a 3 to 7 year reprieve of all this tyranny. And what I'm trying to say, and I think what you're trying to say, is in the grand scheme of things, I don't care about a 3 to 7 year reprieve, because it's going to happen at some point.
It's inevitable.
And the longer we wait for this to happen, the worse it's going to end up being. And so, again,
did you see the forecaster? Did you get to see that?
I saw like half of it.
Okay,
because
at the beginning, and if you can get that on video, I had originally downloaded it through Amazon. And I owned it in my catalog, and then Amazon pulled
it. They never hold it from what you actually bought.
Well, it was interesting, because right before the election, for about 3 weeks, I couldn't access it before the general election. For about 3 weeks before, I thought it was interesting, but I have it again in my catalog, but they don't carry it anymore. I mean, because of course Amazon doesn't provide products that people want to buy, you know.
And Amazon wouldn't even be making any money if you actually back out their CIA data storage contract. So, you know, the other day somebody asked me how much money Amazon's making, and actually they don't, you know, until recently they were actually losing lots of money.
Well, he lost money for that long time. He got the CIA contract right after he bought the Washington Post, which is of course a CIA front. Washington Post is Operation Mockingbird. So the stuff that comes out of the Washington Post is just...
It's not even just the Washington Post. And you know, that's a whole nother... You know,
they got that. That was about a $600 or $700 million contract, cloud storage,
yeah.
with the CIA right after they bought the Washington Post. Interesting. But anyways... but
yeah, so just so people know at home, Operation Mockingbird was a declassified CIA program where essentially inside of all the newsrooms, they were getting their talking points from the actual CIA. And so if you don't think that, you know, like a Mockingbird 2.0 type
That's
situation
right.
is going on today,
right.
you're absolutely crazy. It was actually a year ago yesterday that the first time the term fake news in terms of being used
was it a year ago yesterday?
It was a year ago yesterday when it
wow,
was this professor.
It's that recent.
It was this. I mean, I'm sure people have strung together those two words before,
right.
But from a social media standpoint, taking off, it was this crazy professor like Melissa Zandars, and she, you know, basically went to all the websites that you and I go to and said, these are all fake news sites. And so what I did was on the 17th was I made a meme saying fake news sites, and I listed all the, you know, the Snopes and Politico and
right.
MSNBC. I even wrote most of Fox News on there.
Huffington
and,
Post there on
the yeah, page. There was like 30 of them. I had Huffington Post, Washington Post,
Onion.
All these ones yeah. were on there. And I actually had that go viral on the November 17th. So I think I'm actually making the claim that from somebody calling the mainstream media fake news and having it go viral on social media, that I'm the first one. And I have the actual proof in multiple places to show that. Not
that's
just,
awesome.
That's just part of the over, not saying that's
why. We had
why
like, well, like a million or several million imprints, right, on that?
No, I mean, that day the page was seen like 91,000 times, but then it was picked up by other places.
Right,
and then
pushed. Right,
and again, it was just all part of the overall zeitgeist. I'm not like claiming credit of like that's
right, just the way it went.
Right, happened. But what we've tried doing so far leading up to all this is really kind of painting the stage of why central banking is a scam. I have I'll link in the show notes another video that I made. It's like 8 minutes long. That's, I think, titled Why We're All Slaves to Central Bankers. Or you guys can watch my last podcast, episode 6, where I get into this as well. But I think what we want to talk about really now is what the Bitcoin fork is and why Bitcoin forks. So what we're going to do is I'm going to move this, we're going to move the camera screen. All right, so what a fork is. So let's say we've got Bitcoin up here. Of course, I picked the one pen that doesn't work. So we've got Bitcoin up here, and what happened is, let's say you had one Bitcoin, and the ticker symbol for Bitcoin, or would you call that ticker symbol?
Yes, it's a symbol, BTC in the crypto world. We may want to talk a little bit about just a brief review of Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin is a digital currency, and there's really two fundamentals of Bitcoin. So there's really two fundamentals of Bitcoin. Bitcoin, how did it come into being? Interesting. Nobody really knows. It was a white paper written by a mysterious shadowy figure named Satoshi Nakamoto. Satoshi Nakamoto came out right after the financial crisis.
November 2009?
Yeah, I think that's right. November 2009.
It was
2008. So we're
yeah.
about 9 years in now. And it was the white paper is basically a instruction manual on how to create a new currency and a new superhighway of information that could flow with this new currency called the blockchain. So a lot of times the people's all say, you know, have you ever heard of, I'm going to tell you two words, you know, I'll say this, I'm having fun with this a lot. And if you've never heard of these two words put together this way, I want you to remember this because we're going to remember that on November, you know, 14th, 13th, you know, 2017, you were with Matt McKean. I was the first one ever to tell you. It'd be like saying internet. And so it's blockchain because it's going to change our life. But so the blockchain really has two fundamental tenets or concepts that it's built
around. You want to kind of like draw out like the, you know, the blockchain, or
yeah.
I don't know if it'd be too technical to discuss, you know, how Bitcoin comes into existence or what.
Okay, so the blockchain really has two elements to it, and one it is a decentralized ledger of information. And so decentralized means it's not stored in a building in your city, it's not stored in a cloud, you know, that's stored in your database.
Not the Amazon CIA.
It's not the Amazon. It's decentralized. Well, what does that mean? It is in a network of circulating computers that are all independently owned by anyone that wants to become part of the blockchain, and it's continually circulating all across the globe, and these are commonly known as miners.
You want to maybe explain what a ledger is? So I mean,
a ledger is essentially a record of information. So you know, you've got, you own this, you bought this on this date,
maybe,
and then
you know, let's do it this way. Can I see that? I
yeah.
got one pen here that works. So you know, with a ledger, it's, you know, let's say, you know, Bob has, you know, 10 units and Matt has, you know, 4 units. It could be a unit of anything. Let's
right.
say, we could say it's dollars. And then if Bob wants to take two of his units and give it over to Sally, then now what we do is, you know, we deduct two over here, so Bob has eight, and now Sally has two units. So it's just a way of keeping track. And so traditionally what you'd have to do is you have to go through the banking system, or and where, you know, let's say you want to do an international wire transfer, it might be, you know, $45, or you want to do PayPal and they're going to take 2%, or you want to do Venmo and they might take 2%, or you want to, you know, take a, you know, Pony Express and walk it over somewhere.
Right.
You know, that's, there's a cost to that. But this is a way for Bob to give value to Susie without having to involve any middleman.
That's
and,
right.
And the middleman, in this case, is a whole decentralized network where anybody can really be a part of this network if they want to be.
That's exactly right. And that's what's grown is the blockchain. And the second component of this is cryptography. And so I was a pre-med student in college, so my handwriting is really bad. So, but hopefully you can see that means cryptography. When I say cryptography, we say military-grade cryptography. So you have a decentralized ledger that's permanent, stored within the blockchain with 100% infallibility that cannot be hacked, cannot be erased, cannot be modified, cannot be changed, that is done so using validation of transactions to validate the data before it gets burned into the blockchain. So what's beautiful about this is if you and I agreed upon something, never before in human history can Tim and I agree to a transaction where he lives in Romania, I live in the United States, or vice versa. We can agree to a transaction.
A lot of pretty women in Romania.
I was there a few years. Yes, there are. So so without knowing one another, the blockchain could validate who each one of us was with perfect 100% accuracy, validate the transaction with 100% validation, and who has the money that has changed hands, or certain other applications of the blockchain like smart contracts, which is other applications of the blockchain that are going to radically transform our lives. So
let's not get into that right now.
We're not going to, but we're not dependent on a middleman or a law firm, a bank, you know, some other auditing firm or our escrow person to validate all the information. It's now done electronically through the blockchain, through independent miners using mathematical algorithms to encode and protect the information. It's genius.
Then do we want to talk about maybe how it can't be, it technically could be hacked, but the effort it would, and there are some vulnerabilities. I mean, the vulnerabilities would be your individual wallet could be hacked through a brute force attack, but the amount of energy it would take in order to do that, you know, without quantum computing, I mean, you'd have to have like $1 billion in that wallet for, you know, to be able to use the amount of energy. So if it takes you $10 million of energy to get out $50, then you're not going to spend $10 million of energy to get out $50, and you're rewarded more for being honest than trying to screw things up. So with a blockchain...
Well, when you have your information stored here, so let's say Tim owns Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency, you would store that in a digital wallet. And he's the only one that has the keys to those wallet, to that wallet. So it'd be no different if I stole your keys. If you left your... If you, you know, you went down the street to the coffee shop and you left your keys sitting on the table and walked out and left, and I go, huh, I'm going to take his keys and go rob his house.
Yeah, you can be stupid.
So
you can leave your money at an exchange. So the vulnerabilities are at an exchange. If you trust somebody else with your private key, then that's really not Bitcoin's fault. That's your fault. You could have a little, basically like a little USB drive. There's different ones out there, like the Trezor,
Ledger. And
with that, I mean, unless somebody could take your Ledger or your Trezor, unless they actually knew what your password was, it wouldn't matter. And if you were to lose that or break it or run over with it with a car, well, then you can, with these different seed words, be able to then get it back on another device.
Retrieve it.
So it's not gone forever. And so when we say it can't be hacked, is let's say that this is the blockchain. So every time a new block comes into existence, it gets added on to a chain. Well, if you wanted to, let's say, hack the blockchain, you would have to basically hack every other previous transaction that's happened, and the amount of, and then you then have to then find the next block before the other. So let's say this is a bad actor over here, and you've got, I think last time I checked it, like today, it was like 8,000 petahashes a second. Now, a hash is a guess, and a petahash is like, what is it, like 8,000 trillion guesses per second going on in the network. So you would not only have to, be the first one to find this block in a decentralized network of everyone else trying to find the block to the tune of 8,000 trillion a second, but you would then have to then basically go back and hack every other transaction that's ever happened. So the amount of energy it would take to do that and the odds of you pulling it off and the risk reward is so low that you are more incentivized to basically not be a dick and do the right thing than you are to do the wrong thing.
And the one you hack might be a $10 transaction.
Yeah, so you just spent all the world's energy to get $10.
To get $10 because you didn't know what you were hacking.
Well, don't give the Federal Reserve or Obama any ideas because that might be something they do.
But important to that though is the concept of control over your assets because, you know, let's say you stored your money in precious metals and you now want to leave and go outside the country. Good luck trying to take gold out of the country. But with Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, you could walk across the border with $10 million.
Oh, it actually came out.
In the blockchain. And all you need is your keys to your electronic wallet somewhere in the blockchain. And you'd have $10 million.
So this is the crypto and conspiracy podcast. So on the conspiracy angle, there's a guy, James Corbett, of the Corbett Report. And he sued the TSA. And they accidentally sent out like an unredacted version to him where it said literally that those machines are there to be able to make sure gold and silver aren't leaving the country. And then they wanted to have highway checkpoints where you would then condition people. And it's funny because I had a silver bullet, it was shaped like a bullet, but it was made out of silver. And the TSA just absolutely freaked out when I went through there with that. So, I mean, they were... they don't catch, 95% of the fake bombs that go through when they have, when they have the government agents try to, field test these people, but, having one little tiny silver bullet, they can sure as hell catch that. And maybe, do you want to talk a little bit about how, like, the blockchain comes into the existence or how these blocks are found maybe for the people out there? Because we're saying that, all these new blocks get added to the chain, but do you want to talk a little bit about what goes on?
It gets a little technical in the mining community, the miners. So the way the white paper was created for Bitcoin, we're not on forks and other currencies yet, which are what hard forks are. But Bitcoin, the way it's designed, there will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin ever created.
And it's supposed to, and right now there's been 16 million created. And it's supposed to be, by the year, 2140 is supposed to when they have the final Bitcoin.
Produced the last Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So you got about 100 and some years before the last Bitcoin. But so what happens is in 2020, so the mining community solves all these mathematical equations to be able to produce a new Bitcoin. Currently, the price of Bitcoin today is around $7,200 as of right now. And... a Bitcoin currently, according to the data that I see, costs more than $1,000 in manpower, labor, electricity, and hardware to be able to produce one Bitcoin.
So and these are people who are getting their electricity as cheap as possible. You're in Venezuela where it costs nothing, or previously we're in China, not anymore really, but at least from the ICO standpoint. But they also have... they got miners that are literally plugged into volcanoes in Iceland and using the
geothermal energy.
It still
cheap.
Costs $1,000.
That's right.
To produce one.
So
of these
it's
Bitcoins.
A ton of computing power to do it. And so what people's always
it is larger than the Google network. It's if you put it all together,
it's billions and billions of dollars of hardware that support this. So when people say there's no intrinsic value to Bitcoin, it's just some number that's made up. No, it's not. It's not some record the guy created on a Word document and stored on his computer at work. It is a indelible unit. And interestingly enough, there is belief that because Bitcoin early on, the way it was stored and people had it, the 20% of the existing float of currency is gone, hidden, lost forever.
Or
people
think about
a hard drive and threw the hard drive away, never thought it was going to be worth anything.
Or think like Silk Road, the people's assets confiscated in that, or when Ross Ulbricht had his, and then the FBI came in and basically stole some of his. So there's,
CIA.
Yeah,
yes,
so he's got all these.
The guy got nailed, the FBI agent, didn't he? recently. They found it. They just recently came out. They got caught for stealing his.
And he's and
he was stealing his.
And that's a whole nother can of worms. And actually, at Nexus, I actually had. I was sitting next to his mom at dinner one night, and you know, it's basically the whole drug thing. You know, aside, you know, it's are you allowed to send ones and zeros to somebody else? You know, and not have that be a crime.
Right.
And so, what he was able to do is come up with a way to send ones and zeros to be able to create a true free market. And then they come up with all these BS stories of, you know, oh, we hired hitmen to do this when, you know, again, this is a whole other can of worms that I don't want to get into.
But it's some of the early attacks on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is government will use the money laundering and terrorism. Drugs, money laundering.
The thing is, Bitcoin
was
marketed as being anonymous when really... You know, there's a whole public ledger of exactly what's going on.
Right.
If the government wanted to, I think one of the worst ways to be a drug dealer would be to start using Bitcoin because you've got to, you know, when they do
it shows
crack
exactly
that,
where the wallets are and where the money's going and how it's transferred. And
yeah, I think you'd have to be, you know.
And actually, there are other coins that are used for anonymous purposes. Like the drug world uses Monero.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly from what I have heard.
That's the wrap that
had. And Dash, I believe.
Yeah, that's certain. Dash is actually local. Isn't like headquarters around here, like North Scottsdale.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think Dash is somewhere like down the street, or I think it's close to your office.
You learned
something
all the time.
Dash
okay.
office over there.
Okay.
But yeah, to get one of these without getting technical, to get one of these into the system, you've got a whole bunch of different computers that need to guess a number. The number is, you know, it's like all the atoms in the universe, you know, type number. But it's not like you can just guess every single number at once, because how it works is there's an algorithm. And so what they use is something called SHA-256. And what that means is secure hash algorithm. You know, blah, blah, blah doesn't really mean anything to a lot of these people. But what it means by an algorithm is, let's say I guess 10. 10 is not really the guess. It could be X plus, you know, 90 times 100 minus 4 divided by 7 plus 50. Like, so your 10... would then, your guess of 10 would then add 90 to it, then times 100, you know, minus 4 divided by 7 plus 50, and then that new number is now your guess, not the guess of 10. And so what they're trying to do is whoever can get, you know, can then guess that number is it then counts as one transaction, and then whoever then is able, the second person to then guess it, I should have made this a block and not a square. So then the second person who guesses it then kind of builds off that.
It validates
so,
it.
Validates
right.
it. So eventually you get 6 validations, and then inside of the blocks are the transactions. So let's say I wanted to send you $50. That would be inside of there.
And what this did, it's important, is it's the big innovation was how to secure and prevent the Bitcoin from being sold to more than one person.
What they call double spending.
Double spending. So there was I just sent electronically currency out to 10 different people. The blockchain actually eliminated that and preserved the integrity that coin could only be sent to Tim. Tim could only send that blockchain specifically to me, all recorded and protected through the cryptography.
Because otherwise what people could do is, you know, hey, I could spend, you know, give you 50 and I can give you 50. And then basically, you know, I walk away with the goods, but really only one person is going to get that $50. So it's a way to then try to, you know, safeguard against that. But what we're getting into now is, you know, the Bitcoin fork. And so a lot of you, you know, are probably wondering, you know, what the heck is going on with this fork? You know, what is a fork? And essentially, getting back to this example is, you know, with Bitcoin... And again, this is not going to be a big technical analysis of this. Is you know, you've got, you know, information over here called the header, and then you've got, you know, other scripting code. And again, this is more like layman's, and I'm not getting into all the different rabbit holes we can get into with this. And then you've got all the various transactions. Well, one of the problems is that now that Bitcoin has gained a lot wider adoption, is that, you know, all these transactions are, that the 1 megabyte blocks are completely full. As a matter of fact, there's like a backlog of, like, last time I checked, like over 100,000 transactions. And so what people are doing is saying, hey, well, in order, you know, I really need to get my transaction through, so I'll spend, you know, $20 to make sure I'm at the top of this list. So what the miners are doing is they're saying, hey, well, when I found that Bitcoin, how the, so when that Bitcoin is rewarded, whatever miner finds that, they get to keep all these transaction fees. So it's incredibly profitable for these miners. And so back in the day, it may have only costed, 20 cents or 2 cents or $1 or $2. And now it's started getting up to $20, $30, whereas you might as well be using a bank if it's going to be 20 or 30 bucks. And so one of the ways to basically correct that is, there was different methodologies. One of them was going to be doing something called segregated witness. So let's say you had one Bitcoin. Then when Bitcoin did a soft fork in August 1st, and I don't want to get super technical into this, your one Bitcoin, you still had the same Bitcoin, but now it was operating off this other software called SegWit. But then you also then had another, what they call a hard fork, where a hard fork is, you're at Home Depot and, you need to get a bigger shed. So you just, go buy a bigger shed. It's, and you trash the old one. Whereas a soft fork is, you maybe, build an addition onto your current shed. You don't really have to necessarily change the entire, underpinnings of that. So with Bitcoin Cash, how they wanted to solve this is basically say, and obviously this is not the scale, but they wanted to have everything keep the same and have an 8 megabyte block. And whereas the Bitcoin SegWit people is saying, hey, we've got a better way to be able to do this. And what was going to happen is that then we're going to have another soft fork called Bitcoin or called SegWit 2X. I don't really want to get into all the again, I'm not a technical expert on this. Mm-hmm. And I'm better with the Federal Reserve type stuff. And there's people that are a lot more knowledgeable on this than me. But essentially, they had one way of doing it. These guys, said, hey, we're just going to make it bigger. And what happened was they saw the price of Bitcoin skyrocketing. There wasn't a lot of confirmation in terms of, hey, are the miners going to be on board with this? And then really they called off the agreement. And so a lot of people are like, well, hey, you guys promised that this was coming and that this was going to then solve the scalability issue. This was going to solve the transaction fee issue, and it was going to make way for this Lightning Network, which is a whole other can of worms. But then you guys reneged and everything. And since you reneged, now we're going to take some of this, and we're going to take some of our Bitcoin and move it over to Bitcoin Cash. And again, if you owned Bitcoin prior to August 1st, you had one unit of what they call BCC, and you still had your one unit of
BCH.
Or
Bitcoin Cash.
Yeah, I think I've seen it both ways on different exchanges.
Different,
BCC some or BCH. So some BCC, some BCH, doesn't really matter.
Like CoinMarketCap is kind of one of the big sites where people look at.
That's what I use.
They're BCH on CoinMarketCap, but BTC is always the original Bitcoin, and Bitcoin Cash. A lot of people in the Bitcoin community were mad, and some of them won't even call it Bitcoin Cash. They call it Bcash. Because they're like, why didn't you call it ABC Coin?
And then some of these people like Roger Ver, who's known as Bitcoin Jesus, are now calling this Bitcoin SegWit because it's a different protocol. But that's over the heads of, actually some of this is over my head even, but so it's surely over Grandma and Grandpa's head. So I don't really want to get into all the specifics of that. But really another thing I wanted to do is and it's probably really hard for you guys to see, so a lot of people are probably listening to this, so it doesn't really matter. But what we have is a chart where it shows the average transaction cost. And what we are seeing on this chart is, Bitcoin was pretty reasonable. In January, it was like, 20 cents, 30 cents. It starts getting up to, $1, $5 come, July. And then, end of August, it's like $8. And then all of a sudden, it starts getting up to like $20 a transaction. Whereas you've got you've got Bitcoin Cash is coming in right now. I'm pulling this up right now, but Bitcoin Cash is coming in at 8 cents, 11 cents, 12 cents, 14 cents. At the same time that Bitcoin is into the many dollars, and you've got other ones like Litecoin, where Matt said he made a transaction the other day that cost a penny. So maybe
$150 in Litecoin. I said.
Yeah, so maybe you want to get into how. The transaction issues. Now some of them might be like $100 bill, or is one.
Sure. Yeah. So you'll hear things like Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, there's it's morphed into, is Bitcoin going to be a currency you use all the time? Will I be paying for a coffee in Bitcoin?
Store of value.
Or is it becoming more of a store of value? My personal philosophy is that Bitcoin, the way it sits, will become more like gold, like a reserve. And so if you think about, I use example, if you have a $100 bill, you've got a $100 bill, right? And a $100 bill, you need to buy something for $100, pretty easy. Now, if I go down to the carnival, you know, and I walk up to a hot dog vendor and I hand them a $100 bill, they may tell me something like, we don't accept $100 bills. I can't make change for that. So if I'm going to send you
$30 and it costs $20 for me to send it, I'm not going to do it because it's going to cost.
It makes sense if you're going to send me, you know, $100,000, or I'm going to sell you a condo for a couple hundred, you might pay that in Bitcoin and, you know, a few dollars or whatever, not a big deal, if you're going to send me $5. So you've got other coins that have been developed. One of those is a coin called Litecoin.
Bitcoin would be for my Ferrari, and then the other
right.
one would be for my
gold,
bubble gum.
Silver, other things like Litecoin. It was created by Charlie Lee early in the innovation of Bitcoin. He took the original white paper of Bitcoin, and he basically created a completely all different alternative currency based upon what he saw. And so there are thoughts like a Litecoin is it's faster. So what you're seeing with cryptocurrencies is they're all trying to solve a few problems. One, speed. You know, cost, right? Scalability.
And some of these
right?
are...
anonymity, like Monero, right?
And some of these are more like operating systems, like if you want to get into Ethereum. So it's sort of like a Mac versus
PC. It's a decentralized, PC. Like a decentralized platform to launch software, decentralized software.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a Mac versus PC thing, whereas other things are more like applications where, let's say I use QuickBooks. You know, QuickBooks is an application inside of either Mac or PC, or let's say Facebook is something I go on inside of there, or
right.
you know, any other software I use. So people see all these other coins coming out, but some of them are more have specific functions. Like just because QuickBooks came out, and then there's 1,000 other applications that do, you know, maybe one's a music player, so you know, one's iTunes. So it's iTunes, you know, you're gonna say cryptocurrency is a bubble because you've got iTunes doing one thing and QuickBooks doing another
right.
thing, and you know, password managers doing another thing.
And this is why when we get into the blockchain and what it's going to do to our lives in the future, this whole decentralized the model we had of computers. Imagine your computer, your phone even, not running inside the phone, but pulling the application that's running out of via the internet off of the blockchain. That's kind of what we're seeing. So I think things like a Litecoin, for example, which is fast, very inexpensive, an original hard fork off of the Bitcoin, doesn't mean Bitcoin's not valid. It just means there's technologies now where they can swap back and forth. We're seeing a lot of innovation in the space. I think what's important when I personally see Bitcoin, though, is that some of these things, attacks on Bitcoin, if you will, some of them, it's questions about, is it really better? Is it financially motivated? You know, the 2% is always going to try, there's 2% of the people are always going to try to, you know, exploit a system.
Psychopaths of the world is always
or exploit monetary opportunities. But, you know, Bitcoin is, if Bitcoin can be replaced that quickly with something new, so one day it's worth $7,200 and the next day it's worth $100, which hasn't happened, that would create tremendous instability and the confidence in the entire crypto space. So that's, you know, the traditional rule in marketing is be first, be better, be different. So back in the day, you're too young for this, but we used to, when the video cassette recorders came out, I don't know if you, do you remember those ever? You
yeah, I had a
VCR. Okay, so there's the first one that came out was called the VHS, and it was big, it was bulky, it was a tape, you had to rewind them.
You had the Betamax.
And then the Beta came out afterwards. The Beta was smaller, faster, better in every single way. Sony the Betamax did, never caught on, because VHS became the standard. And it was good enough.
A lot of it always has to do with whatever the porn industry is using. I know, that's actually the true thing. It's like the same thing with, like, you know, because there was a battle between Blu-ray and HD, it was an HD DVD.
Yes,
HD. And actually, I was kind of surprised because I thought with backing of Microsoft, I thought maybe the HD DVD, and I had my HD DVD, connection to my Xbox, and I'm like, great, you know, that completely worthless. So, and actually real quick, because I think we could sit down after
sure.
this, yep. is that there was then another fork, what was it, yesterday or 2 days ago, where it was a Bitcoin Gold. So essentially, if you had Bitcoin, never sold it, you'd have your Bitcoin Cash, you'd have your Bitcoin SegWit, and now you'd have your Bitcoin Gold. And then I'm not an expert in Bitcoin Gold, but I think what they're doing is they're trying to take the mining, instead of using these, you know, big systems hooked into volcanoes of geothermal energy where you've got to be, you know, basically this, you know, the ExxonMobil of this massive conglomerate in order to compete, is they wanted to bring it back down to the mom and pa, you know, kid in their basement using their computer to be able to mine this and taking it away from, you know, the centralization of all the miners. So I just wanted to squeak that in before we sat down. But I don't know what we want to get into. I think lastly, maybe let's get into, you know, is Bitcoin a bubble? You know, that's been a, you know, pretty widely debated subject. And then and also want to talk about, you know, how Bitcoin is connected to the Bilderberg Group, and then finish it off with, you know, how people are always talking, you know, so short term about Bitcoin. So I don't know if you want to address, you know, is the Bitcoin a bubble aspect of this, because that's surely something we see online. We've got mutual friends that have made comments that Bitcoin is a bubble, but I want to, you know, I want your take on why you either do or don't think Bitcoin is a bubble.
Okay, well, so bubbles, historically, the term bubble usually happens when there's an unnatural over concentration of capital in one place. So the real estate, you know, implosion that happened back in 2007.
And we're in Arizona, which is one of the hotbeds of it. Like the second hardest hit area behind Vegas? Easily top three.
Top three. And so you had an overconcentration of capital due to financial instruments that allowed any person to borrow money, and access to capital drove up real estate prices. You didn't have to qualify. All you had to do is have a credit score, essentially, not even a down payment, and ta-da, you own a home. And
fog and mirror.
You want to buy another one? You buy another one. Well, that created artificial demand because of financing, and so we saw a real estate bubble. It was inevitable, and we won't get into the reasons for that. But
you can watch The Big Short.
Yeah, it's Big Short, and another conversations behind how that happened. But so bubbles usually happen when there's an unnatural concentration of capital in one market. So we saw in 2000, when the dot-com bubble burst, you had companies that were IPOing.
Pets.com.
Pets.com, who had no product. They had a name of a company with an idea and a web address and nothing else, and said, we want to IPO our company, and our valuation is going to be this because we believe we're going to do all these. This is a completely crazy idea. So Bitcoin as a bubble doesn't meet that criteria, because first of all, the market cap of Bitcoin.
Maybe some of the ICOs can meet that criteria. If you got an ICO, we got an idea and a white paper, and it's 50 pages.
Well, an ICO is a different conversation.
It's different.
So, those are some similar to tech.
So there's a lot of pets.coms
that
are out there of the...
Sure, there's ridiculous, you know, Bitcoin there. You know, the crypto community refers to a lot of those as shitcoin.
Yeah.
it's shitcoin. So there are some shenanigans and unscrupulous people will try to prey upon. That's why China came down pretty heavily upon ICOs, because they saw people being taken advantage of and duped. And instead of buyer beware and letting people be free to make dumb decisions, you know, the big brother government wants to step in and prevent people from hurting themselves, right? So is Bitcoin a bubble? Well, Bitcoin, the market cap for Bitcoin is about 110
billion,
115, almost 120 billion, I think, this morning.
Depends on the second.
Yeah, it slides around maybe several billion dollars throughout the day. Bigger than the market cap of Goldman Sachs, the world's largest investment bank. However, in the grand scheme of global currency, it's very, very small. A lot of people in the crypto world, and now in the institutional hedge funds, they believe that the crypto space will go to $5 trillion in the next 3 to 5 years. So the whole crypto market right now is just over $220 billion, which is unbelievable to me, because a few months back, it was 70. I remember when it hit 70 70 billion. Now the whole crypto space with all the crypto coins, about 220 billion. So if it's going to 5 trillion, if you think about it as a currency, it'd be like saying, you know, the dollar's a bubble, or, you know, is gold a bubble? You know, it's how do you really call it that? I think, I don't even think that's proper. They're trying to say is, where's the price discovery on the valuation? And you would have people like John McAfee who believes Bitcoin's going to go, the price of Bitcoin is going to be $500,000.
I think his exact quote was actually, if it's not $500,000, I will eat my dick on live television.
Is his actual quote. By 2020, or 3 years. You said within three
I didn't. I wasn't sure what the time frame
was. He said within 3 years.
Is.
Yeah. So he's yeah, it's an interesting illustration. But so in terms of a bubble, Bitcoin is seven. I think because it's climbing quickly, you have to understand the underlying reasons behind it. There are people, if you look at Venezuela, which the country's been decimated with hyperinflation, socialist policy, communism, socialist communism.
There's 100,000 people, miners there, who are mining Bitcoin, because, and that's like the only way they're even able to like eat.
Have made money.
Essentially.
I didn't know it was that big.
Yeah, it was 100,000 last time I checked. That were mining Bitcoin. And I think another point I want to make is in the dot-com era, the first time I started looking at investing, I was 15 years old. My grandfather was going to give me $1,000 because he saw me interested in CNBC and all this stuff. And that was back before I was too young to realize that it was really CNBS and that there are a bunch of horrors on TV. That, but again, you're 15 years old and or 14 and you know, you don't know any better. So I really actually wanted to buy into Bluetooth in 1998, 1999, and my grandpa's like, you know, you think that people would be walking around with cell phones and listening to music, and now it's like, yeah, well, duh, everyone has Bluetooth. But I feel like this is like Bluetooth times a bajillion, but the fact of the matter is I didn't invest back then because I was too scared, and I just gave my grandpa back $1,000 because I thought it was like a billion back then, you know, growing up, you know, someone hands you $1,000, you're 14, 15, you know, things like $1 billion. So I kind of wish I did that, and maybe I wouldn't have to go to college. I don't know, because that would have been a pretty good investment. And but the fact is, there are, whether you know the whole industry is a, whether there's the whole industry is a bubble versus, you know, there are the Amazons in there. There are the you know, like the Bluetooths in there. There are things that are going to survive, whether or not, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, whether there's 1,000 cryptocurrencies and 950 of them are shit. You know, it's not my problem that you overextended into the ones that are shit. You know, that's not my prerogative. But back in the tech bubble, where I was going with this is that everybody essentially had, actually, just a second, I said my micro SD card is full. So we've got no more video going on here, but we can still go through this. But, you know, back in the day, though, every single person had tech stocks. Everyone had tech stocks. But then how many people, you know, I'm in the wealth management business and maybe like two of my clients have cryptocurrencies. You know, other people, other advisors I know here, you know, this guy has one, this guy has two, this guy has one, but we have a lot more than just one or two clients. And so it's, you know, it's a very, very small percentage of people who are walking around with cryptocurrencies. It might be 0.25%. Whereas in the days of dot-com, it was everybody. In the days of tulip bubbles, it was everybody. And I was on the radio, you know, earlier this year talking about this. And here's actually really cool, you know, for those of you just, you know, listening in, there's a chart at Visual Capitalist. If you type in Visual Capitalist, Zero Hedge, Bitcoin, it was from November this year, 2017. And what it's showing is, you know, each one of these little squares is worth $100 billion. And it shows the market cap of, you know, silver, just one tiny ass little square, and cryptocurrencies, it's, you know, again, very tiny little squares. And it shows, you know, the biggest companies, you know, the FANG stocks that are out there, you know, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Berkshire. And it shows, you know, the 50 richest people, and shows, you know, a few more blocks. Then shows California GDP, and shows, I'm just estimating, maybe it shows, you know, 20 blocks. Then it shows the Fed's balance sheet, which was $3.5 trillion, which that was just added onto, that's just during QE. I think it's like $4.4 trillion, so it's even bigger than this. And it shows several blocks there. Then it starts getting into, you know, USA and the amount of currency. And for the people that are listening to this, the takeaway is that the amount of currency versus the amount of Bitcoin is like, it's like a, you know, a pimple on the ass of an elephant. I mean,
yeah.
Whereas the elephants, you know, the currencies and the pimple is, you know, the Bitcoin. It's nothing. And you look at all the value of all the gold in the world. Again, relatively, you know, relatively small. Then it shows the value of all the stock markets. And these are, again, just eyeballing this, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of times the market cap of what cryptocurrencies are. Then you get into the global money supply. And this is where a chart that you guys need to see. I'll have it linked into the show notes, where this is just a huge freaking amount of, it's showing that you've got, you know, 36.8 trillion of easily accessible money, and then another 90 trillion of money that's not as easily accessible. Then you start getting into global debt, and it's at 215 trillion, where, again, this is like a needle in the haystack, where, you know, the haystack is all the debt and the needle is, you know, the cryptocurrency. Then it shows, you know, all the value of global real estate, and again, pretty big number. Then it shows the derivatives, and this is where it starts really getting interesting, where you're at 544 trillion, and I've seen other numbers that suggest that it might even be into the quadrillions. But anyways, I am scrolling down, and it took me a good like 4 seconds of like scrolling down just to get to the bottom of this. So we're talking a market cap of $100 billion, but if you talk about the debt, we're looking at closer to, you know, this estimate is 544 trillion. So, you know, what is the bubble to me? I mean, the bubble to me is not the, you know, second smallest thing on this graph. The bubble to me is the amount of debt, but nobody really knows how all this is going to shake out. And again, we'll have this linked into the show notes. But the last thing I want to talk about, because we're at an hour now, so I want to kind of wrap this up, is when it comes to Bitcoin, one problem I've had about Bitcoin really from the beginning when I found out about Blockstream was I looked into, well, you know, who runs Blockstream? Blockstream, the biggest investor in Blockstream is a company.
Explain what Blockstream is.
So Blockstream, good point. Blockstream is basically, they are what's known as like the core developers of Bitcoin. They're the ones who are kind of doing, you know, developing the code, kind of steering what direction it's going to go into, you know, for lack of a better word.
It's not really a company. It's an affiliation of people, really.
But they, I mean, they do have a lot of funding behind them, and they are paying people to
right.
to do code. So,
yeah.
You know, and what kind of what happened was, you know, a lot of the, you know, people that got in this because they were anti-bank, people that were, got in this on philosophy, a lot of those people have been kicked out, and now it's more of like globalist type people who are in it. And it's actually, so Blockstream is the, they got their funding from a company that's known as AXA. It's spelled AXA or AXA. And so when I heard, I saw that, I just, when the first time I heard of Blockstream, like, well, what's Blockstream? And then I saw, well, wait, they're run by, or their major funder is AXA. And I just happened to know that the Bilderberg Group was headed by a guy like Henry de Castries, or however the hell you pronounce his name. And he was the head of AXA up until about a year ago. So, I mean, now I don't know what he's doing, you know, figuring out how he's going to take down Bitcoin. Or so, you know, I don't feel from a philosophical angle that, you know, I want to put all my eggs into the Bitcoin basket when I know it's being in somewhat steered by the same globalist who I was trying to get away from in the first place. So again, it's decentralized. So, you know, not saying they can come in there and, you know, and have their way with everything, because you've got to have all the miners on board, and you've got to have the nodes, and you've got to have the users, and there's all these competing interests. But, you know, are they in there? But what would I be doing if I was trying to mess it up? I'd have, you know, really high transaction fees. I want to make it less able for the average person to use. And basically, I'd be doing all the things that are going on right now, which is maybe a reason why people are going into Bitcoin Cash. But it's I'm just very disheartened that I don't see a lot of big-time people in the industry pointing this out. And yesterday, I happened to watch a little clip of Luke Radowski and Jeff Berwick, and I was pleased to see them actually talking about this. And I didn't get the idea to talk about this because I saw it yesterday. It's funny because I talked to you briefly yesterday before I even watched that, but I was pleased to see these guys talking about this.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, you know, we probably hit you guys with a lot today. We hope to be doing, you know, coming out with these regularly. Again, you can find it on the Libertarian Advisor podcast, which is on, you know, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Player.fm, Podbean, YouTube. You can go to libertarianadvisor.com. Up there, we'll have it posted with all the links to everything else I just mentioned. We'll have some of the show notes in there, the transcriptions. you know, let us know, you know, other topics you guys want us to cover, whether it's in cryptos, whether it's in conspiracies, you know, because, you know, really there's a lot to keep up with. So the cryptos and conspiracies is going to be like a subsection of the Libertarian Advisor podcast, where we've got Libertarian Advisors going to be more, you know, geopolitics, you know, current events type stuff that's going on. Whereas this is going to be more of the different, you know, cryptocurrencies and conspiracies. Because I know not everybody listens to me. You know, some people don't give a shit about the political angle. Some people don't give a shit about the crypto angle. Whereas I don't give a shit if you don't give a shit, because now I've got it. Now I've got it segmented out where you can decide, you know, hey, Tim's talking about markets. You know, Matt's you know, talking about the markets. I don't care about that. I want to hear about the conspiracies. Well, now you've got the method of doing that. But anyways, you know, appreciate you guys watching or listening today. We'll be out with more of these in the future. And, you know, thanks for Matt for joining us. You know, he's going to be a regular part of this. And we're signing off, and see you guys later.
Enjoyed it.
One of the most important steps anyone can take in investing is figuring out how much risk they can handle. We use a tool called Riskalyze, which gives you a custom risk number between 0 and 100, with 100 being the riskiest asset you could have in your portfolio and 1 being the least. In 5 minutes, we can tell you what your risk number is, and if you'd like, we can arrange to also tell you how much risk is in your portfolio, as well as what the hidden internal fees are, dividends are. This is incredibly valuable information you'll want to help prepare for your retirement. We know that not everyone